Or James B. Davis will present argument for the petition.
To please the court. The court, in its granting the writ of application for error in this case, has recognized the facts that are essential for the consideration of this appeal to this court. But may I just state briefly that what we're concerned with here started out as a rather simple agreement. That is, that two parties would exchange 40 acres of real estate and an equal minimum interest thereunder. And in the background, at the trial court conference preceding the agreed settlement, all of the witnesses and parties to that agreement have testified in this case that the agreement was that each party would convey to the other a one-half mineral interest. The settlement agreement was dictated cautiously into the records of the court, and that has been introduced into evidence and is a part of this record. Regretfully, the attorney who dictated the terms of the settlement agreement did not state the percentage of minerals to be one half. This case, as you have noted in your granting of this application, has been tried once to a jury and appealed. A district judge granted a summary judgment on a different ground than mutual performance. Came back, it was tried again, but another jury felt that the solvent should prevail. And that case is here before us. The Court of Civil Appeals, in its analysis of the evidence, started off with the logical syllogism that there was a dispute in the evidence as to the percentage of minerals to be exchanged between the parties. And based on that major premise, reasoned that there was a necessity for a jury issue on the percentage of minerals, and that the Thalmans failed to request and obtain that jury finding as percentage of minerals, and therefore the case must be reversed and remanded for a new trial. Our position has been, was at the trial and still is, that the evidence in this case conclusively establishes as a matter of law that the parties agreed to exchange a one-half mineral interest in the exchange of the 240-acre tract. Now the respondents here at the appellate court level in the San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals cited the case of Dick Bittner versus Bell for the proposition that the Thalmans should not prevail. However, that case clearly recognized the distinction and the exception to the general rule that a jury issue is required, and this court clearly established the rule that no jury issue is required if the evidence conclusively establishes as a matter of law a vital element of a party's cause of action. And that is the Washington versus Reliable Insurance case cited by Bush. Now the basic principles and rules of law that govern the facts of this case have clearly been established and followed by this court consistently. And there's four areas that this court has addressed where a party is not required to have a jury find an element of their cause of action. And this court has announced in the Sullivan versus Burnett case that no issue to the jury is required on an undisputed fact. Now, when we look at the evidence in this case, there is no dispute in the evidence that the parties did not agree to exchange a one-half mineral interest in the exchange of the two deeds. That's simply not disputed. The court has gone further and said in the Navarro case that the testimony at the trial, where the testimony at the trial and all the circumstances and the subsequent actions of the parties point to only one conclusion, and that there's nothing to suggest anything less than the truth, and where there was no cross-examination on a particular point to be established, that under those circumstances, but not limited to those circumstances, a fact issue may be established as a matter of law. When we look at the facts in this case, all of the circumstances in this case clearly point to the fact that they agreed to exchange one-half mineral interest. Because the very first thing that Mrs. Porter did when she obtained her first deed from Mr. Stallman was to enter into a contract with the Stegalls to sell that very 40 acres she was to receive and a one-half mineral interest, not less than one-half mineral interest, in fact, to the Stegalls. And then it says we can look to the actions of the party. What did she do? Her and her attorneys did everything they could do to see that she got a one-half mineral interest from the farm, and in fact issued a title policy to the Stegalls guaranteeing them that she did get a one-half mineral interest from the farm. Our most recent case, not in the brief because it, well, it is in the brief, but site was not, the Burke Royalty versus Wall case says that not only can you look to all the circumstances, but you may determine a party's state of mind, and that state of mind may be established by actions of that party and the circumstances surrounding that action. So what did Mrs. Porter do? Well, first, she clearly agreed that she would first accept a deed from Mr. Thorburn. That's the first thing required by the settlement agreement that was dictated into the records of the court as here in evidence. First, Mr. Thornton would convey to her his 40 acres and whatever mineral interest. And then based on what she received from the Thornton, she would then convey to him her 40 acres and an equal mineral interest, not just equal in value, but equal in real interest. Now this circumstance, which she said she clearly understood in the trial court, stated under oath, and that she freely entered into that, when we look at all the circumstances in this case and all the actions of the party, they clearly meet the test of the Navarro set out by this court in the Navarro case, and the evidence establishes under that rule that there was an absolute agreement to convey a one-half mineral interest. Now, in the Campbell v. Booth case, which is not a Supreme Court case, but it was approved by this court in that writ of error was refused, no reversible error. And in that court, in that case, the court says that if the evidence is of such a conclusive character that reasonable minds could not differ, and only one conclusion may be drawn from the evidence, then a fact has been established as a matter of law. And this court has even gone one step further than that. They say even if the undisputed testimony of an interested witness or party, here Mr. Thalman, that pertains to a matter to be proven, is reasonably capable of an exact statement, and if it's clear, direct, and positive, Then it says the jury should not be allowed to speculate as to the witness's veracity. Here, Mr. Thalman, at the settlement conference, was concerned about his mineral interests. He was in the oil field business. He knew that Sun Oil Company was drilling in the immediate area where his land was located. He wanted to be sure he obtained 1/2 mineral interest. He obtained a guarantee, not only from Mr. Murray, the attorney who represented Mrs. Porter at the settlement conference, but he also obtained a guarantee from Mrs. Porter, a person whom he knew, that she owned 1/2 of the mineral interest and that he would get 1/2 of the mineral interest. Now that testimony is clear, direct, and positive. That's an exact statement, and Mr. Thalman was never cross-examined on that point. Nobody ever cross-examined him on that point. Now, when we take these rules of this court and apply the final test set out in the Sedeknik case by this court, it says where the adverse party's evidence to dispute these vital facts is so weak when compared with their actions and admissions that such evidence is in legal effect simply no evidence. Now, what evidence was there to dispute the fact that Mr. Thalman, Mr. Cavail, his lawyer, Mr. Castellon, the lawyer who dictated the settlement agreement into the record, all stated that there was an unequivocal agreement to exchange 1/2 mineral interest. What evidence was used to dispute this fact? The only evidence to dispute this fact was some undetermined, indefinite statement on the part of Mr. Murray that he thought there was some option and the party should have some option. But when we look at the court settlement that was dictated in the record, and the court reporter was present and took down every word that was said, when we look at Mr. Murray's testimony that there was some option, that the parties had some option concerning the minerals, I have to agree with Chief Justice of the San Antonio Supreme Court, who says this testimony is just absolutely inaccurate and unbelievable, because if the court reporter was taking down every word, why would the court reporter leave out the conversation about an option when they took down every word that everyone said, even Mr. Thalman, Mrs. Porter, Mr. Castellon, and Mr. Murray? Why would they leave out this conversation about the option? I say that the trial court properly found that as a matter of law, the parties agreed to exchange the 1/2 mineral interest with the 40 acres. Now, the finding of the trial court is just as binding as a finding of the jury. And we have to note that this finding of the trial court has not been challenged as to the factual or the legal sufficiency of the evidence to support it. Therefore, the parties and the reviewing courts are bound by the trial court's finding. And this is the Providence Hospital case cited in our brief. You have to remember that the Porter heirs have never attacked the trial court's finding as to whether or not the evidence was factually or legally sufficient to support the finding. So we respectfully request that this court sustain our point of error number one and find that the trial court properly found that the parties had agreed to exchange one-half mineral interest as a matter of law. Now, our second point of error addresses that part of the Court of Civil Appeals opinion that relates to the jury's findings on mutual mistake, which were special issues number two and special issue number three. Special issue number two, the jury found that Mr. Murray failed to incorporate the true agreement of the parties, that is, that each party would exchange one-half mineral interest in, with the two deeds, and that this come about as a result of a mutual mistake. The Court of Civil Appeals found that the record does not support any finding of mutual mistake. And the Fallmans contend in their application for writ of error that the evidence concerning mutual mistake clearly and inescapably establishes as a matter of law that all parties to the exchange were mistaken about one aspect of the transaction, and that is the effect of the language used in the deeds. And that is the mutual mistake, and that is the one aspect that they were mistaken about. The Court of Civil Appeals found that the Fallmans and their attorney was mistaken about the effect of the language in the deed, but that Mrs. Reporter did exactly what she intended to do, and no mistake was made on her part. Well, this aspect is addressed in our third point of error, which this court has granted us this application on. But let me address the first part. The Fallmans and their attorney first prepared a deed and mailed it over to Mr. Murray. He got that deed sometime in November. Was incorrect because it had some acreage errors on it. They sent it back, and they had two or three deeds that went back and forth. And then finally, Mr. Murray prepared two deeds, one for Mrs. Porter to sign and one for Mr. Thalman to sign. These two deeds were mailed over to Mr. Cavell's office. Mr. Cavell looked at those two deeds. Mrs. Porter's deed had no reservations set out in it whatsoever. That was the first deed that was transmitted to Mr. Cavell. Mr. Thalman signed the deed that was prepared by Mr. Murray and sent it back to Mr. Murray, and he got that deed somewhere between December the 2nd and December the 9th. After Mrs. Porter received that deed, on December the 12th, she entered into this agreement with the Stegalls to sell the 40 acres that she was getting from the Thalmans to the Stegalls, because she took them out to the ranch and showed them the very 40 acres that she was getting. Now, when the first deed that Mrs. Porter was purported to sign came in, and the Thalman and their attorney looked at it, it had no reservations in it. But then a second deed was prepared and actually signed on December the 16th. And that deed was mailed, and it contained the reservations that brought about this lawsuit. Mr. Cavell had that deed from Mrs. Porter, along with a deed that was prepared on March, sometime in March, to meet the requirements of the title company, and Mr. Johnson, who was the lawyer for the title company, required that Mrs. Fallman also sign a new deed, so that the first deed that was provided to Mrs. Porter had to be replaced. It had to be replaced for two reasons. One, it had a conveying all the man's ranch, 120 acres, instead of 40. That had to be corrected. Plus, the title company lawyer, Mr. Johnson, required that Mrs. Thalman also sign the deed because of she being the wife of Mr. Thalman. When they got ready to sign that deed, the new deed in March. Mr. Thalman and his wife went over to Mr. Cavell's office, and at that time, they called Mr. Murray on the phone and asked him, now, do these deeds carry out the settlement agreement? Is Mr. Thalman going to get his one-half mineral interest? His response was yes. Now, if Mr. Murray wasn't mistaken about his interpretation of the deed, why would he tell Mr. Cavell that certainly Mr. Thalman was getting the one-half mineral interest and that the two deeds carried out the settlement agreement if he wasn't mistaken about that, especially in view of his repeated testimony that he never intended to defraud the Thalmans out of their one-half mineral interest, and in spite of his repeated testimony that he knew that the settlement agreement required an equal exchange of minerals. So I not only contend that there was some evidence of mutual mistake on Mr. Murray's part, but I contend that the evidence in this case clearly establishes as a matter of law that there was a mutual mistake about the one aspect of the transaction, and that was the effect of the language that was used in the 2D Murray. But nevertheless, if it wasn't established as a matter of law, clearly there was some evidence in the record that Mr. Murray was mistaken about the language and the effect of the language in the 2D and the special issues as found by the jury should be sustained by this court. There's many basic rules that this court has said. If we're talking about a no evidence point or an insufficient evidence point, reading the Court of Civil Appeals brief, I concluded it was a no evidence point. And under those circumstances, this court has said you must consider only the evidence and the inferences that support the findings of the jury and reject all evidence or inferences to the contrary. But when we look at all, when we consider only the evidence or inferences that support the findings, what other inference could we possibly arrive at when we take a lawyer who tells another lawyer, yes, these two deeds exchange one-half mineral interest? He'd have to be mistaken about the effect of the language in the 2D, unless he intended to practice a fraud on the party. And I certainly do not believe that Mr. Murray was attempting to practice a fraud on anybody. But we have to note that Court of Civil Appeals looked to the request for admissions and the answers to the interrogatories that were propounded to Mrs. Porter during her lifetime in reasoning that she was not mistaken, because there was no other testimony in the record from Mrs. Porter other than her answer to request for admissions and her answers to interrogatories. Admittedly, under Plaintiff's Exhibit 43 and 45 and 46, Mrs. Porter, under 45 and 46, Mrs. Porter, by her answers to interrogatories and her answers to requests for admission, she stated that she and Mr. Murray agreed to put a reservation in the deed because the Thalman deed had one. And then she admitted that she never intended to convey any mineral interest by her deed. But we have to remember that this court has ruled not this court, but the Beaumont Court of Civil Appeals in the Sprouse case has ruled that the answers to interrogatories and requests for admission can only be used by the party who made those requests, and it can never be used by the answering party to support any contentions that they have during the trial of a case. And even if the party who admits them in is not the answering party, he's not bound by any answer that's been given that is contrary to any position that he has in the lawsuit. Okay, in this case, there was either a mistake or either they intended to practice a fraud on Mr. Thalman. In order to establish that there was a fraud, the answers of Mrs. Porter were introduced into evidence to say that she intentionally put the reservation in the deed and that she never intended to convey any mineral interest to the Thalman. I put that into evidence at the trial to support my position that in the alternative there was a fraud practiced upon the Thalman by virtue of the actions of Mrs. Porter. I'm not bound by those answers when it comes to the proposition that there was a mutual mistake made. I can use those answers to prove the fraud, but I'm not confronted with a situation where those answers can be used against me under my position that there was a mutual mistake made in this case. So I think not only was there some evidence in this case that would require the reversal of the Court of Civil Appeals findings and as to special issues number 2 and number 3, but also I say that the evidence in this case establishes as a matter of law that there was a mutual mistake under the very principles of the foregoing cases under point of error number 1. First, it was not disputed that Mr. Murray was mistaken about the effects of the 2D. And point of error number 3 is the one I've just addressed, is that the interrogatories that the answers to the interrogatories that the Court of Civil Appeals used to support their finding that the Porter, Mrs. Porter, was not mutually mistaken about the effects of the deed. But Mrs. Porter, there's no evidence she ever actually saw the 2 deeds. Mrs. Porter acted through her agent and attorney, Mr. Murray, in preparing the deeds in question, and is bound by his acts, i.e. the mistake interpreting the language of the 2 deeds. And this is the Carter versus Converse case that's cited in our brief. Now, Mrs. Porter has admitted under request for admission number 19 that she did not select the language in the 2 deeds. If she didn't select it, then she's bound by the act of her agent and attorney, Mr. Murray, in selecting this language. And she's also bound by his interpretation of the deed. So therefore, I say that this case that started off awful simple, that has become awful complex by the processes through which it's gone, should be set at rest by this court. I simply say that it's the duty of courts to sustain the judgment of the trial court if it's correct on any theory of law that's applicable to the case, in accordance with this court's ruling in the Guff Land Company versus Atlantic Refining Company at 131 Second 73. It's not in our brief. this is a simple case whether either there was a mistake or there was a fraud. We have alleged, we pled fraud, we proved fraud, we... Thank you.
You may finish your sentence, counsel.
Thank you. We have proved fraud by the, and obtained jury special issues to the answers as to fraud, and we think that this court should consider our point of error as to fraud and rest this matter once more. Now, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the court might have.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear argument from the respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Eugene Stewart, an argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I am Eugene Stewart and I practice with firm Petrie and Petrie in Parisa Springs. We're here today representing S.J. and George Martin, who were the defendants, part of the defendants in the trial court, and were the appellants in the Court of Civil Appeals. Mr. Mike Kane is also here. He represents Sun Oil Company on this appeal. And if I might just take a second to explain, I'm going to be taking all the time on this because effectively what has happened is in the petitioner Thalman's brief, they have admitted that unless this court reverses the Court of Civil Appeals holding regarding the Thalmans, then the court would be required to reverse the holding as the Sun Oil Company. In other words, if the Porter heirs are still alive in the case, then no judgment should be entered against Sun Oil Company because they were only secondarily liable anyway. So the main contention is going to be between the Porter heirs, the Martins, which we represent, and the Thalmans. Now, the position of the Porter heirs, S.J. and George Martin, on this appeal is fairly simple. The San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals correctly found that the error in the trial court, and the only mistake that the Court of Civil Appeals did was in not going ahead and rendering judgment, which the trial court should have rendered, and that is that the Thalmans take nothing. And it's our position that this court should do just that, should go ahead and render judgment based on the errors found by the Court of Civil Appeals and render judgment to the Thalmans take nothing. Now, this case has a lengthy legal history. It's been in the courts for about 11 years now. This is the third appeal. But I don't think that should really complicate the matter any. It actually probably clarifies a lot of the issues as we go along. This arose out of a settlement agreement of a prior case in 1969. In 1969, Eunice Porter filed a suit against C.L. Thalman and his father for trespassing upon her land and for cutting her fences. The suit sought damages and an injunctive relief. Now, in settlement of that lawsuit, there were two 40-acre tracts exchanged, and the deeds were drawn up, signed by both the parties, exchanged, and an order of dismissal with prejudice against Mrs. Porter was entered. Her trespass title suit is gone completely with prejudice. So everything went along from 1969, 1970. Nobody was raising any complaints. In 1971, oil came to Dimmitt County, and the Thalmans are back in court asking for greater mineral interest. Now, they had not complained at the time of the original exchange of the deeds, but whenever the oil came in, they did start raising complaints. Now, there has been a second jury trial in this case, and following this latest jury trial, the appeal went up to San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals. The judgment that would have been entered was a judgment reforming the Porter to Thalman deed, effectively deleting a term reservation in that deed. Now, the case went up to San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals. They considered three points of error. They first considered a point of error that the Thalmans had failed to obtain a jury finding on a material issue of fact, that being the intent of the parties to the Porter deed as to what mineral interest was to be conveyed. The Thalmans contending that there was to be a half mineral interest conveyed, the Porter heirs contending that there was a dispute as to that and that there was evidence in the record that the only mineral interest that was intended to be conveyed was exactly what was conveyed, that being a remainder interest after a 25-year term. The second point of error was that there was no evidence of a mutual mistake regarding the Porter to Thalman deed. And the third point of error was that there was insufficient evidence of a mutual mistake on the Porter to Thalman deed. Now, the Court of Civil Appeals found the first two points of error were valid. It considered, I assume, the insufficient evidence point. Its holding is not very clear from the opinion as to whether or not they would have also held that there was insufficient evidence. If that became an issue in this appeal, I think that the court would have to send it back to the Court of Civil Appeals to get a clarification of their ruling on that point, since this court obviously cannot rule on that itself. But as to the failure to obtain a jury finding and as to the no evidence points, this court can make a ruling. Now, it's important that each one of those errors is sufficient independently to reverse the judgment. So in order for the Thalmans to come out of this appeal correctly, to reverse the Court of Civil Appeals, they have to win on both of those two points of error. In other words, they have to show that the San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals was wrong on the first point of error about not obtaining a jury finding, and they were also wrong on the no evidence point. If the Porter heirs are correct on either one of those points, they prevail. So with that in mind, going to the first point regarding the lack of a special issue on the percentage of minerals to be conveyed. Now, it's not disputed, and I think there's three factors that need to be taken into consideration on this point. It's not disputed that such a fact-finding is critical to reformation of the Porter deed. In other words, you have to have a fact-finding regarding intent. Second, I don't think there's any argument that there was no issue requested by the Thalmans, and none was submitted on that. And third, that the Porter heirs clearly objected to the charge on the ground that it did not contain such an issue. Now those three undisputed points then in compliance with Rule 279 would mean that the Thalmans waived a jury finding on the intent issue unless there is no dispute in the facts as to the intent. If there is some evidence in the record to raise the fact issue, then the Thalmans have waived the fact finding. Now, Mr. Davis in his argument has gone over the various, ways in which courts have articulated this conclusive evidence standard. There's various methods depending on whether or not there was no evidence or no admissible evidence or whether there was not a scintilla of evidence, and I don't think I'm going to go into all those cases. I think the court's very familiar with them. But basically, we look at the evidence that is favorable to the Porter heirs. Now, in doing that, I want to go back first to what the settlement agreement reads. Now, in Mr. Davis's statement to the court, he was talking about there was an agreement that Mr. Thalman would exchange his property and then Mrs. Porter was required to exchange an equal minerals to whatever Mr. Thalman conveyed to her. Now, that's simply not in the agreement. This is the language of the agreement. After it talks about exchanging the two tracts, it says, condition the mineral rights which the parties may convey to each other in this exchange of 40-acre tracts is equal. Now that is the only thing in the agreement regarding the minerals as to the percentage of minerals that they wish to convey, sets no order as to who is to determine what is in one deed and what is the other. The only thing is that whenever it's all over, they're supposed to be equal. Now, obviously, if you're drawing two deeds, you have an infinite number of ways that you can draw two deeds so that the mineral exchange will be equal. You can convey no minerals in both deeds. You can convey all the minerals in both deeds. You can convey half the minerals in both deeds, or any combination thereof of minerals, so that the two deeds would exchange equal minerals. Then we get into the real, the real problem that arose whenever you were trying to draw two deeds that conveyed equal minerals, and you don't have a starting point. You don't have anything to compare either one of them to. You're just starting out, you're going to draw two deeds that convey equal minerals. And you run into an immediate problem in that there are already outstanding reservations that are unequal. The Thalman tract and the tract that the Porter heirs had, or Mrs. Porter had, there were already outstanding reservations in third parties that were unequal. The Thalman tract was burdened with a 25-year term reservation. Now, I have put in my application or in my reply this kind of in graph form, and you can see the unequalness of the two reservations. On the Thalman tract, you have a 25-year term reservation. On the Porter tract, you had a perpetual reservation. They are both a half mineral interest, but time-wise, they are very different. They're extremely different. In fact, at the time of the exchange, the Thalmans, rather than owning a half the minerals, you could actually say that they owned all of the minerals subject to a 25-year reservation of a half, because they were going to obtain the remainder back. Now, the importance of this comes whenever you look at the Thalman deed. If you look at the Thalman to Porter deed, it's very important here, because there is only one reservation in the Thalman to Porter deed, and that was the already existing term reservation. So Thalman conveyed to Mrs. Porter half of the minerals now and half of the minerals after 25 years. In other words, all of the minerals subject to a 25-year term reservation. Mrs. Porter did not have that to give Mr. Thalman. There is no way that anybody could have drawn the Porter to Thalman deed in that state of the Thalman deed and have matched the mineral grant. Mrs. Porter only owned half. That's the very most that she could have given. She could not match a half plus a remainder. So she comes up with the problem, how are you going to equalize these minerals? And now I think Mr. Murray took a very appropriate course on this. He said, all right, we will put a matching 25-year term reservation in our deed. We'll put it in our deed. That'll match up the term reservation over there on the Thalman deed. Now, at that point, all that needed to be done was to put another half mineral reservation in the Thalman deed, and we'd equal them out. Now, it wasn't done. But going back to the intent, we have to remember that the deed that Thalman is trying to change is the Porter deed, which under that scenario, there's nothing wrong with it. You could have equalized minerals by changing one deed alone, and that was the Thalman deed. Now, it's interesting to note in this respect that you can delete the term reservation from the Porter deed, and unless you also change the Thalman deed, the minerals exchange is still not going to be equal. You have to change the Thalman deed, no matter what you do to the Porter deed, you have to change that Thalman deed. It's wrong. It's wrong. But you can change it and not change the Porter deed and correct the whole situation. Now, Mr. Davis said that, and getting back to this, it's conclusively established what the intent of the parties was, the statement by Mr. Murray regarding the option. And I'd ask the court to check the record because I don't think it's any ambiguous or slight or anything else. Mr. Murray was very clear in his statement. He said, when Mr. Castillon dictated the standing right by him, he used the word may. When he finished the sentence, I objected to his use of the word may. I wanted the word option in it. He explained that may was an option, included option, so I made no further objection as long as we understood it between us. Now, that was a conference between attorneys. I don't think it would necessarily be picked up by a court reporter. Court reporters are normally picking up statements to the court. You had here, they were dictated the settlement agreement. Mr. Murray turned to Mr. Castillon, said, I don't like the word may. I want option. Mr. Castillon says, that means option. Same thing. You have an option to convey or retain, same thing. There is no way that you can ignore that evidence and find that it was conclusively established that Mrs. Porter intended to convey a half mineral interest. The evidence is there that Mr. Murray intended to put the term reservation in, and he did it for a purpose. He intended it in there to equalize the term reservation in the Solomon deed. The evidence, you have the settlement agreement itself, which says may. It does not refer to any specific percentage of minerals to be conveyed. And you have Mr. Murray's testimony that he talked to Mr. Castillon, there was to be an option, and that he put the term reservation in the Porter deed for a good reason, and he did it deliberately. Under that evidence, I think it is very clear that there was definitely a fact issue. At least there was a fact issue as to what the intent of the parties to the Porter deed was, as to whether or not she intended to convey a half or whether she did not. And looking at the evidence in light favorable to the Porter heirs, and including all of the reasonable conclusions to be drawn from that evidence, I think it's clear that it has not been conclusively established that the intent of Mrs. Porter was to convey a half mineral interest. And I think that in such a situation, the Court of Civil Appeals very correctly held that the Thalmans had waived the fact-finding on that issue. Now then, I want to turn to the second point that the Court of Civil Appeals upheld, and that was that there was no evidence of a mutual mistake. And much of what I've said about the disparity in the original reservations has to do with this point of error, that there's no evidence of a mutual mistake. And probably this point of error is one of the hardest to comprehend under the facts of any of them, because it's very difficult whenever you have two deeds that are supposed to have equal mineral reservations and they don't, to not say that there was a mutual mistake. However, let me go back to that definition that was contained in the charge regarding mutual mistake. Mutual mistake as used herein means a misapprehension of the draftsman of the instrument in question and the recipient thereof, each of said parties operating under the same mutual mistake as to the legal meaning and operation of the language employed in the writing. Now, Mr. Davis, on behalf of the Thalmans, would like to cloud this issue, put both deeds together, and say that somehow there was this gigantic mutual mistake regarding both deeds because they're not equal. Now, the Porter heirs admit the two deeds do not convey equal mineral interest. And I'd be willing to admit that there was a mistake made problem comes in is that the mistake was made by the Thalman's counsel in not putting an additional reservation in the Thalman deed because he misinterpreted the Porter deed regarding a perpetual one-half reservation. Now, to explain this, Mrs. Porter had already signed her deed, sent it in. The Thalmans were ready to sign the final deed. We've already heard there were a number of drafts. They had before them the Porter deed. They were with their attorney, Rufino Cavallo, going over the Porter deed and going over the deed that Mr. Thalman was to sign. Mr. Cavallo, as is indicated in the First Court of Civil Appeals opinion in this case, misconstrued the Porter deed. There were two reservations. The first one said that the grant was subject to a perpetual reservation in a third party. Then there was a second reservation, and it starts out, the above-named grantors reserved for the 25-year term. Mr. Cavallo thought that that was only one reservation for 25 years. He knew there was a 25-year term reservation there. He could see that. But what he did was he discounted the prior perpetual reservation. He thought it was all the same language, so he just discounted that prior perpetual reservation, thinking there was only a term reservation. Now, under that misconception, the Thalman deed and the Porter deed would have exchanged equal minerals. Because if you discount the prior perpetual reservation, then they both only have term reservations in them. The problem is there is absolutely no evidence in this record that Mr. Murray ever harbored under that same mistake of fact, that Mrs. Porter ever harbored under that same mistake of fact, or that anybody on her behalf ever harbored that same mistake. They knew there was a prior perpetual one-half reservation, and they knew that there was a term reservation in the Porter deed. Mr. Cavallo was the only one that didn't know that. If there is some evidence in this record regarding what Mr. Murray was mistaken as to, he may have been mistaken as to what the Thalman deed conveyed, because he was not particularly clear as to what Thalman owned. He was not sure whether or not there may have been a perpetual one-half somewhere back in Thalman's title. But he knew exactly what the Porter deed conveyed. He had no mistake about that. To have evidence of the mutual mistake is to reform the Porter deed, which is what the judgment does, reform the Porter deed by deleting that term reservation. There would have to be some evidence that that term reservation was not intended to be put into the Porter deed, and that it was put in there as a result of a mutual mistake. There is no evidence of that in the record. The only evidence in the record is that there was a mistake made by Mr. Cavallo in discounting the prior perpetual reservation. Not that he made a mistake as to the term reservation. Now, in talking about this, I feel that I'm fairly encumbered upon me to go back to that First Court of Civil Appeals opinion, because it was written by the San Antonio Court of Civil Appeals and Justice Barrow's opinion, so I feel encumbered to comment on some of the language regarding...
The presentation is right on that.
regarding some of the language that was used regarding and analyzing that evidence. Now, it's the same evidence that I just went through, and there is language indicating in there, although it may very well be dicta since the case was reversed, that there was some evidence of a mutual mistake, and I want to go over that evidence that was quoted. in the opinion, it says, "Nevertheless, we believe there is other evidence in the record that raised an issue that Mrs. Porter was mistaken as to the effect of her deed." She alleged that the 1969 agreement conveyance of the mineral interest would be optional, which we still allege, and that if they did convey, that they would be equal in mineral interest. There was nothing to show that she did not intend to carry it out, and that the uncontradicted evidence establishes that the deed signed by Porter conveying his tract to Mrs. Porter was actually prepared by Mr. Murray. Now, I don't really have any qualm with that statement of the evidence. This is the part that really I get into a qualm with. It says, "It was thus known to him," this is Mr. Murray, "in his capacity as agent for Mrs. Porter, prior to the delivery of the deed, that a one-half mineral interest was to be conveyed." Now, I assume it is talking about to be conveyed by Mr. Thalman to Mrs. Porter in the context of the statement. That statement, one, is based on an assumption, and two, is not complete, and in that sense it's erroneous. One is based on the assumption that Mr. Murray knew all the prior reservations in Thalman's
system. Well, Mrs. Porter agreed to convey half of that she got from Thalman to Stegall?
Well,
these things were exchanged.
All right, you get into this. You had a contractor sale, which was signed in December, which described the general tract of land, does not particularly describe the 40 acres that are involved here. And does call for a one-half mineral transaction. It is true that the 40 acres did eventually go under that contract of sale. I do not think there's definitely any evidence in the record that shows that they were originally to be included or that they were included in that. And you get into this problem right here, that if you assume, let me just go back to the statement, that the statement is incomplete in the sense that if Mr. Murray did know about the prior reservations, then he knew that the Thalman deed conveyed not only a half mineral reservation, but also a remainder after 25 years of the other half. So the court is effectively going into hypothesis by saying that, well, he intended in the Porter deed to equalize the half and not the remainder. I mean, it's entirely consistent that he could draw the Porter deed to equalize the remainder interest rather than the half. He couldn't equalize both of them. You couldn't draw a Porter deed, Porter to Thalman deed, that would equalize both of those mineral conveyances of both the half perpetual and the remainder after the term. So consistently, all he would have had to do was equalize one of them. That's all he could do was equalize one of them. And I don't think that that is evidence of a mistake on his part in equalizing the remainder rather than the current conveyance. Finally, I want to take just 1 minute here on our point of error regarding the render. And the two points of error that were appealed by the Court of Civil Appeals are both points of error that this court in the past has said that a Court of Civil Appeals should ordinarily render a decision and not remand. Now, the remand in this case by the Court of Civil Appeals, there is nothing in the opinion to state why they remanded it. They do not say that they remanded it in the interest of justice. They do not say that they remanded it because it was not the case was not fully developed. They assign no reason. Under the case decided in our application for writ of error, the failure to assign a reason by the Court of Civil Appeals is error in its of itself. It is the improper exercise of discretion in remanding. In remanding without assigning a reason. Therefore, the Court of Civil Appeals erred in remanding. This court also has some discretion in whether or not to remand. And in that regard, in looking at Rule 505, I want the court to take note of some of the factors which I think do require a render in this case. One, we have a long legal proceeding here. If ever there was a case that has been fully developed out to the very last, this is it. It's been tried to two different jury trials. Everything that could possibly be brought out was brought out in the last trial. Second, there's absolutely no indication by the Thalmans in any of their briefs or applications to this court that there is any additional evidence that is going to be admitted on another trial. There is none. The remand of this case to the trial court would serve absolutely no purpose, because we would be right back up here again on the same evidence points and the same failure to find the agreement of the parties. They obtained all the jury issues that they requested. They didn't get their finding. They waived it. And under such circumstances, I think that this court should properly render a decision.
Thank you, counsel. Hear the response from petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just briefly address the Sun Oil's appeal. The Court of Civil Appeals' opinion has left a kind of a dilemma when it leaves the foreman recovering from Sun Oil and reversing him. And I admit that one should only recover in the event they're successful on this appeal or in the subsequent retrial of the case if the retrial becomes necessary. But I don't admit that the judgment as to Sun Oil and the court's and jury's finding that they had actual notice of the foreman's claim and that Les Pendes applies to them as purchasers of the oil and gas from the properties in question. If there is a reversal in this case, then it should not be reversed to Sun Oil, except to the extent that the foreman recovered from Sun Oil. I think the reversal should simply be that and Sun Oil, I'm sure, is willing to pay to the prevailing party the money that are held in escrow. However, we sued Sun Oil Company jointly and severally along with the Porter Heirs for the money that was wrongfully paid to the Porter Heirs during the period of time that they had actual notice and Les Pendes notice of the Thalmans' claim. So I say that there is a reversal in this case. It should not be as to Sun Oil Company totally, but only as Sun Oil Company should pay to the Thalmans only if they prevail either in this appeal or at a new trial if a new trial becomes necessary. They're talking about this court should reverse and render, and certainly it's the prerogative of this court to reverse and remand, and especially where the ends of justice is to be obtained. I certainly can't think of a case where the ends of justice would cry out louder for the Thalmans to recover their one-half minimum interest than in this case. Kind of like having to swim out in the cold water and get your hat, and as soon as you get back on the bank, you find you got to jump back in and swim out and get your coat. If this court finds that Court of Civil Appeals has in fact committed error in its ruling concerning the issue on the point of error number one, to send us back to the Court of Civil Appeals and have them consider whether or not the jury's finding on special issue number two and three are against the great weight and preponderance of evidence. Well, that court has already said that there was no evidence to support it. Puts me in a quandary. Of course, everybody must follow the rules of law and the rules of the court. But the ends of justice in this case, under the evidence in this case, which clearly shows that both parties were mistaken about the language in this deed, in these two deeds. That is a mutual mistake. It's established as a matter of law. And if this court so finds, as requested in our brief, this entire matter will be set at rest. Now, Mr.
Stewart has addressed this court on what could have been done. Well, yes, a lot of things could have been done that weren't done, and that's the reason we're here. The equities in this case have been satisfied by the court's judgment. The 25-year reservation that passed through Mrs. Porter to the Stegalls is to be returned to the Fallmans pursuant to the court's judgment and the agreement and the stipulations of the Stegalls. That is not a, that's moot. That's moot. The Stegalls, realizing the inequity of the situation, has agreed and stipulated that they will convey back to the Fallmans their 25-year reservation, provided their title to the property as guaranteed through to them is established. So we don't have an inequitable situation to deal with. We don't have an impossible situation to deal with. We've got one thing to deal with here, and that is to sustain the trial court's judgment so that the Fallmans will get their one-half mineral interest, which they contracted to get, and which they will get if this court sustains the judgment of the trial court. Now, there was some mention that about the option. Now, Mr. Castellon, the attorney who dictated the option, testified in this case, and his unequivocal statement on the witness stand was that there was absolutely no mention of option in this case until Mr. Petrie became the lawyer in the case. And this positive direct statement, coupled with the court transcript that does not contain any word whatsoever about an option to retain any minerals. The court settlement clearly says that they will convey to each other. It doesn't say that they'll retain anything. And this was made such a big issue at the trial that we submitted a jury issue to find, have the jury find, did they agree to convey or retain? And the jury found that the parties agreed to convey their mineral interest, not retain their mineral interest. Sure, Mr. Stewart would admit that Mr. Cavell made a mistake. I admit that he made a mistake. But that mistake was brought about by the positive, unequivocal statement that Mr. Murray made to him at the time Mr. Murray was encouraging the Thalmans to sign the second deed over to Mrs. Porter so that she could get her money from the sale of her 1,000-acre ranch. And that statement was that, yes, the Fallmans are going to get their one-half mineral interest. No problem. These two deeds carry out the terms of the settlement agreement. That positive statement could not have been made by Mr. Murray, a practicing lawyer, unless he was under the mistaken belief that the language in the two deeds did, in fact, exchange equal mineral interest. There's no other conclusion that can be drawn unless we want to say that Mr. Murray was attempting to defraud the Fallmans by having them sign a deed over to Mrs. Porter conveying one-half mineral interest. Okay, now he says that Mr. Murray might have been mistaken about the Fallmans, what minerals the Fallmans own. Well, that proposition holds absolutely no water, because the Stegalls required a title policy be issued by an abstract company guaranteeing them not less than one half of the minerals on the land that they were getting from the Thalmans. This attorney who prepared the abstract of title and the title policy wrote the letter to Mr. Murray setting out the legal description of the land that was to be conveyed, and Mr. Murray copied that legal description right out of Mr. Johnson's letter and put it in the Thalman deed, knowing full well, and Mr. Johnson was acting as Mrs. Murray's attorney, Mrs. Porter's attorney, and she's bound by his knowledge and his acts. They all knew that she had to get one-half mineral interest from the Thalmans so that she could carry out her contract with the Stegos. So the proposition that Mr. Murray wasn't mistaken about the interpretation of the language in the two deeds just simply cannot stand. He couldn't have been anything else unless we want to say that Mr. Murray was attempting to defraud the Thalmans out of their one-half mineral interest. And I don't say that at all. But if we don't say they were mistaken, then we have to go to the other side of the coin and say if they weren't mistaken about the interpretation of the deed, then they intended to extract from the Thalmans a one-half mineral interest and give him nothing for it. I don't think this court would entertain such a theory. Thank you.
That concludes the business of the court for today, and the marshals will adjourn.
Would it have been done in 1972?
You mean with different people?
Yes, with different people.
You're suggesting then that the Rule 37 permits are granted on the basis of personality?
No, sir. No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that. I'm saying simply this, that different judges, different administrators will make different decisions but on the same facts. What I'm trying to say is every judge does not necessarily decide a law question precisely the same way that every other judge does.
Nor think it was a hypothetical question. Would an ordinary prudent railroad commissioner acting fairly without regard to personality is correct? There's no way you John Doe or Joe Smith crank one.
But that's the way it was framed, and it was also framed. Would the commission grant? The question was asked in 1978. Conditions were markedly different in 1972 from what they were in 1978. And for that additional reason, this hypothetical question should not have been, the answer to it should have been excluded. Now,
did you object to the issue?
We objected to the question. Yes, sir. Yeah, we certainly did. Now, mention was made of the Stansbury. What is that? Two more minutes. Bye. Right. Mention was made of the Stansbury case and the fact that there was a 200-foot strip in between. Well, the Stansbury case is clearly a case of localized drainage. That's what was going on there. In fact, the jury found that a certain number of barrels of oil were drained by one well and by another well on the Bill Daniel lease away from the Stansbury lease. Now, that's localized drainage. There weren't any wells on the Stansbury lease. It's an entirely different situation from the situation you had in the Woolley case and in this case. Now, as far as the exemplary damages are concerned, they say there was a tort there. I haven't yet heard what the tort was. I heard the word misrepresentation. There's some mention of a letter that was written. But I don't see either any pleadings, any issues, or any evidence that there was any knowledge that this was a false statement that was made, or any reliance by the Alexanders or anyone else on those statements. I do not see the elements of fraud, nor do I hear the name of what kind of a tort this was. It may be some new tort that has to be established here, because I haven't heard yet in any of this argument or in the briefs just what the tort was. Now, in the Hardy case that was mentioned, you have specific jury findings on the various elements that go into a case of fraud, knowledge, reliance, and so forth. You have that in that case. You do not have that here. This is simply a different situation totally. All right. Respectfully say that yes, Amoco produced itself depleted. It tried to get all the oil out of them it could. It did so, though, under the rules and regulations of the Railroad Commission. There's not any showing in any degree that it produced more oil than it had the right to produce under the rules. It is said that the rule of capture has been limited. Certainly it has. It's been limited by the regulations that the Railroad Commission puts out. But this production up here, which of course did affect the Alexander lease, there's no question about that. The more oil is produced up dip, the more water is going to be pulled in. This is the nature of the beast. There's nothing that can be done about it. That's nature. If this court should expand the covenant to protect against drainage to include field-wide or regional drainage caused by water drives such as this, they're placing a virtual impossibility on the operators of down-dip leases. They're telling them that they must do something that they really can't do because it's like swimming upstream. It's against nature, and it can't be successfully accomplished. We ask that the commission reverse this cause on the ground that field-wide drainage is not to be included in the covenant to protect against drainage. And for the further reason that the evidence was improperly admitted on, in answer to the hypothetical question.
Thank you, counsel. The court, of course, recognizes the importance of the case. And, counsel for both sides are invited to file any post-submission observations and view of our questions or anything else that you may have within the next couple of weeks. You don't have to file anything, but if you can help us, we'd be glad to have the help. All right, go and take a brief recess. All right.